This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with SharePad from ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.
Hello and welcome to this Twin Peaks Investing Podcast. This is podcast 128. And as you can see on the screen, hopefully you're on the screen, you're watching us on YouTube. We have a guest with us today, and we've got Andy at Flying Finance. We'll tell you a bit more about Andy a bit later on. I'm also here with my guests, as well as two co-hosts. So there's four of us on the screen, ladies and gents, today. Of course, we've got Henry Viola here. That's HD Viola on Twitter. And we've got Phil Oakley. That's everywhere, apart from on Twitter. He likes to keep it that way. And we've got Andy at Flying Finance. And after we've listened to him, you'll be well within your rights and be considered person if you choose to follow him, because he's a very smart cookie. We're going to find out about his investing journey, what he does in his full time, and what he does with his part-time regarding his investing. But first, I'm going to go straight to Phil, who's been tracking the markets. Like, I don't know. I think he's just got it in it for the markets at the minute. He wants to be on top of almost everything because of all the different entities that he's writing for. So, Phil, let's go from the top first before we get into the meet and greet with Andy at Flying Finance. What are your thoughts? What have you been looking at? And what would you like to get us triggered on to be thinking about now regarding the markets?
Well, there's a lot of really sort of, you know, same as usual almost. Not much has changed, but it seems to me like, you know, we said a couple of weeks ago that the US market was like struggling to sort of push higher, and I think there's a lot of concern now coming into the market that the US market for a long time is something that's just demanding more of a sugar rush in the form of lower interest rates and cheap money, and it's not going to get it. And I've even heard the talk now, some talk now of actually the next move in interest rates actually being up rather than down. And given that the US economy is actually performing reasonably well, inflation is quite stubborn. It wouldn't surprise me if the next move in interest rates is up. But as I said a couple of weeks ago, I said almost that doesn't matter, because I think the other thing that, you know, you need to keep watching is the bond market. And, you know, Treasury yields have been going up. It's not been easy for the American government to sell bonds. And when you've got either Trump or Biden, and the same over here, whichever political party seems to be in, they're going to be spending a lot of money. They're going to be spending more money than they take in taxes, and that's going to be funded through bonds. And the risk is that those bonds have got to pay higher rates of interest. And if that's the case, then that's a real headwind for the stock market. But over in the UK, you know, we've had more sort of bids. I think even as we speak, or just before we've come on air, we've had the BHP bid for Anglo's. That's over now. Post Office, Royal Mail, not the Post Office, Royal Mail looks like there's an agreed bid, but that's far from done and dusted, given the political issues there. And the other one, obviously, last week, which I thought was really interesting, was Hargreaves Lansdown, where they came out and said that a private equity consortium looked to buy them at $9.85 a share. And that was rejected. And of course, you know, a share that no one's been interested in for months or arguably years, everyone's now interested in again because someone's come out and said, hey, this isn't as bad a business as people think, and it might be cheap. And I think there are a lot of businesses out there in the UK that have similar characteristics to Hargreaves Lansdown, and they're going through a bit of a tough time. They've got a few challenges. Their share prices have fallen a long way from their peaks, and it wouldn't surprise me if we continue to get more bids. I've actually put an article out today on the ShareScout website actually discussing this, and I've put a list of about 15 companies out there that I think they're pretty solid businesses. They're on reasonable valuations. The shares have come off a lot, but they're actually forecast to grow. And these are decent businesses. I'll name some examples. Companies like Whitbread, WH Smith, and SSP. I've known them as a pair. I've named them as a pair because they're quite similar, in that you find a lot of their outlets in airports, railway stations, motorway service areas. They make good profits. So things like that, EasyJet, going for very, very cheap valuations. So I think this thing about bids, this story about bids, is going to keep going. And I think there's plenty of places you can go fishing in the UK stock market at the moment.
I absolutely agree, and we spoke several months ago about it also impacting investment trusts, which were lowly valued. And we saw that one today for FSF, the Foresight Sustainability Forestry play, and that went up 30% on a recommended bid. But I want to go back a bit regarding, sorry.
I think you make an interesting point on the investment trusts. I was reading something the other day about the amount of buybacks going on amongst investment trusts now.
Absolutely.
The discounts are so big that one of the ways, the only ways that they can shore up the net asset value per share and close the gap between the share price and the net asset value per share is to buy back shares.
Absolutely. And the ones that aren't are winding down their strategies or looking to merge with somebody else. So there's lots of consolidation going on. I spoke with the CEO of Association Investment Companies, Richard Stone. Was it last week? I think it was last week, for the Investing Matters interview. That'll be coming out in about two, maybe 3 weeks' time. So there's some information on what's going on there and what they're looking to do to reform some of the issues that are impacting investment trusts. So that should be quite interesting. But I wanted to go back, Phil, regarding some of the stocks that you spoke about. Because I know that Andy, who we've not spoken to properly yet, has got at least one of them. Henry has had one of them as well. And I've got another one of them. So I want you to go firstly to Andy as our guest, if I may, and just say hello to him. And you can do a fuller introduction a bit later on, Andy, to tell us about the stock that you've got that's in and amongst the takeover sort of chat at the moment. Which one's that? And what's happening with it? And what are you thinking about doing with it?
So I've got IDS, which was formerly Royal Mail Group. I've held it since before COVID. I can't remember what price I bought it at now, but obviously I think that pretty much quadrupled during COVID up to around £6, rings a bell. And then I should have got out at that point. Post-COVID, didn't get out. But now it's seeing a bit of a resurgence. The latest offer is, from memory, 360 plus some dividends and some other bits. That actually makes it effectively £3.70 a share. The share price has reacted to that. It has gone up. I'm not sure what it closed at today, but it's still a fair way down from the offer. I forget the Czech billionaire's name that's put in the offer now. But it's quite interesting. You see quite a lot of these offers coming out and shares, the price just jumps straight away to meet it. That Royal Mail is one of the few that haven't been within a couple of percent of the offer price. And clearly there's a lot of political risk there, particularly with what's looking like it's going to be a Labour government coming in just a couple of months' time. Will that bid go through? Personally, I have my doubts. I think even with a Conservative government, it's not a done deal by any stretch of imagination. Hence, it hasn't closed up towards that bid price. I'm sitting on the fence. I'm just waiting, biding my time. It is still drifting up quite nicely, just a couple of percent here and there at the minute. The RNS just came out, I think it's this morning, confirming the exact details of the offer. But I will probably be looking to clear that one out of my portfolio just in the next week or so. I don't hold a huge amount of it, just a percent or so. But for me, the risk of it going down should the offer not go through is probably greater now than closing up the gap towards the offer price.
Yeah, I mean, the chap's name is Daniel Kretinsky. And given that, you know, most indicators, most polls are saying that Labour is essentially going to win it, win the election. The price, the full price, including all the dividends and specials, is £3.70. It's closed in or around £3.32 today. So it's just shy of a 10% gap. And the risk there, of course, like you say, Andy, is that it drops 15 to 20%. So it goes sub £3 if Labour do win. And they go, nah, we're going to keep that as it is now. We're not going to let somebody else win it. And like you say, there's political risk there regarding the security of the mail and all the rest of it. But essentially, it's in private hands as we speak anyway now, you know, essentially. So it's just changing hands. So I don't know what Phil thinks of that particular deal or Henry, but personally, without giving advice, if I was holding that stock, I would have already taken some off the table just because of the level of risk. And it's 10% risk, reward, if you get the full amount for 370, for a risk of 20%, really, I think, if it doesn't go through. And it would take a little while to get through all the legal hurdles anyway. So you're sitting there waiting around for 6 months to a year for 10%.
Yeah.
You can do better than that in your own investments, I think. Henry, your thoughts on the IDS one?
Yeah, I agree with Andy, to be honest with you. I mean, we spoke about this on a previous podcast, and I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure what this Czech guy is really thinking, to be honest, buying it. I don't really see it's a great acquisition target, but we'll agree to disagree on that. He's a billionaire and I'm not. That aside, I think there is a serious risk with a Labour government getting in that they block the deal. You know, and for a 10% upside, you might as well, you know, sell your shares and walk away, in my mind, because it's not a done deal. The market clearly doesn't think it's a done deal. And until that money's in your pocket, anything could happen. And as I learned the hard way on Darktrace the first time round, just because somebody makes an offer doesn't mean it's actually going to go through.
Absolutely. I'll just pull the details up here. And what the bit that of concern, Andy, regarding your IDS, is the bit here under the National Security and Investment Act and NSIA, the government potentially has the power to block the deal. If it concludes the national security could be at risk, a foreign takeover might raise concerns about the security and continuity of critical postal and communication services. But the thing here is we shouldn't worry because Jeremy Hunt says it's possibly going to be fine. Bearing in mind the likelihood of him being in government in the next 3 months or 2 months, 6 weeks is minimal. So we can just, as with most things that Jeremy Hunt says, we can just, you know, ignore it, I think. Phil, any thoughts on the IDS one? What do you think will happen with this deal and the current price, where it's at, the discount, where it's at? And will Mr. Kretinsky be able to write the check? Ha, ha, ha.
He might be able to, actually. You know, he seems to be making the right noises to try and keep the politicians happy. You know, he's committing to not breaking the company up yet, because this is what he wants to do. Because I think this is a great example of a business where there's some nice value in the parcels business. You've got a UK business, a European business, and a US business, essentially delivering parcels and items. That's a growth market, one that players with scale can do well in. And it's just the letters business which spoils it. If it wasn't for the letters business, the multiple that you would attach to this business would be a lot higher than what it is. And of course, it's kind of like a poison pill within that. Hence why, you know, the bid is at a reasonably low level. This is a business that's thrown off a lot of cash, despite the letters business. So there is a good business in there, and he is committing to keep the six days a week letters delivery for the next 5 years. I mean, to be honest, I think that's going to have to be addressed anyway. The Royal Mail letters delivery business is clearly unsustainable in the form that it is, and I think we're going to be moving to a three-day delivery for our letters sooner than probably most people realize. It's already happened in countries like France. It's arguably going to happen here, because the economics don't stack up, and we'll see. We'll see, because I think it's going to take a while here. This is something that's not going to get sorted out anytime soon, but it's the politicians have the scope to make it interesting, either by blocking it or by allowing the letters business to somehow be split off. And if that happens, then you'll get other bidders coming in for this. So I think it's a share to keep an eye on. Because I actually don't think the bid for it is actually really, really that high. The actual money on the table. So if there was something that allowed this to be broken up, which I know is a big if, I think you get a materially higher value for this company.
Okay. Does that help at all, Andy, regarding your thoughts?
Yeah, it does. There was also a lot of talk. I can't remember if you mentioned it on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. There was a suggestion that his bid was more to back the government into the corner to kind of force them to seriously consider this mail reform. And it wasn't actually really intended as a takeover offer per se. It was just a bit of a kind of a maneuver to force the government's hand. Royal Mail have been trying for, well, as long as I can remember, certainly the last 3 or 4 years, to come up with solutions that the government will allow to reduce their costs, i.e., delivering every other day rather than every day. So yeah, it's hard to know whether it is a genuine offer that he genuinely wants to take over the business, whether there's more money in it potentially if someone else comes in, or whether it is just a way of forcing the government's hand really on postal reforms.
Yeah, I think you could be right there. You could be right. It's going to prove very interesting over the next couple of months as well. I think, as Phil says, we're going to see lots of takeovers, and it'd be interesting to see who else comes in, irrespective of the result, regarding the elections next month, or the month after next, should I say. Right, Henry, and which one were you going to talk about? You're going to talk about BHP, where you're another one.
Anglo-American. So this isn't actually one of mine.
Yeah.
This is a friend of
Yeah.
mine that owns Anglo-American. So,
Sorry, because I hold it too, and I've been in the process of watching every move it makes regarding it. So carry on.
Bit of backstory on this one. Every couple of months, we have a look at a few shares, this friend and me, and we make a few picks, and they've been slowly building up this portfolio. They bought Anglo-American a couple of years back. And it sat there, and the price went down, and it looked cheap when we bought it, and it looked even cheaper now. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, BHP pops up and has a takeover offer for it. They want to buy the copper mines. They want the company to divest their diamond mining business and a few other bits, the platinum mining business. And all hullabaloo breaks out because they've come back three times now, each time with a slightly improved offer. And today was the final deadline for the final bid, and they had to make a firm offer by 5 o'clock today. And as of this morning, they came out and they said, you know what, actually, our final offer is our final offer. We're not improving this any further. We think we've got a compelling offer on the table. We think we're better value for Anglo-American shareholders. We think you should back us instead of the management team that's running this business into the ground. Sort of a ballsy pitch, to be honest. But anyway, at about 4 o'clock today, might have been a bit later than that, Anglo-American came out and went, yeah, no, to be honest with you, the deal is still not good enough. We're still not going to recommend it. Nothing's going to change. So BHP's now walked away, and Anglo-American has said, hey, shareholders, back us. What this has effectively done for Anglo-American is force the board to expedite their growth strategy. So a couple of weeks back, they probably 2 weeks ago, I think it was, they came out with a new plan, which sort of mirrors the deal that BHP put on the table just without selling the business. They're going to wind down or spin off the diamond mining. They're going to wind down the platinum mining business. They're going to concentrate on copper. It all sounded marvelous, but the question that, me and my friend are asking ourselves really is, if they've got this plan, why weren't they already enacting it? Because frankly, the business hasn't been doing fantastically well the last couple of years. The diamond mining part of the company, De Beers, very, very old business, but is coming under huge pressure from cheap lab-grown diamonds. So these can be grown at a fraction of the price of real diamonds. Chemically, they are completely identical. You put them under a loop, most jewelers can't tell the difference. You certainly can't tell the difference looking at them. And so there's now massive pressure in the jewelry market for the diamonds business. The platinum market's not doing terrifically well either. Anybody that owns, I used to hold Sylvania Platinum way back. And you can just see from the share price in that, platinum's not doing terrifically well. But the real value here is in what the mining industry calls future-facing commodities. So these are things that we're going to need in huge quantities for electrification and technological applications, and the technology for, what's the word I'm looking for? The technology implementation across society is what I'm driving at. So it's things like copper. Copper is required to put power cables in. It's required in huge
Electrification.
quantities, electrification, but also the
Electrification.
manufacture of things like computers and smartphones. They don't specifically require copper, but they do require rare earth minerals, which there aren't that many sources of them. They're quite hard to get hold of, especially in large quantities. And there's an increasing shortage now between the pipeline of mines that are being developed and the volume of minerals that are being extracted, and the forecast demand. And so the prices of some of these commodities, particularly copper at the moment, are absolutely skyrocketing. And so it'll be really, really interesting to see. My friend's still holding Anglo American. It'll be really interesting to see just what this business does over the next 18 to 24 months, because I've got a feeling if they don't get a move on with this growth strategy and sorting out their portfolio, there's going to be another buyer on the horizon within the year.
This is a quick hello to you, our valued Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener. Whatever channel you're listening to, please make sure to subscribe and you'll always be the first to get the new episodes. Thank you for your continued support.
I agree with some parts of what you said there, Henry. I had an average of £17.50 on the shares, and I trimmed some 2 weeks a week ago on 22nd, at 27.13, left enough there to keep an interest, but just to lock in what was my 57th takeover in 10 years, because I've been doing my sum of parts sort of analysis for over 20 years now. So I tried to look at the margin of safety to buy it, which is what I did with Anglo. And as I was saying before, and I've spoken to a few people about this, there's the whole sum of parts for the business at the moment is about £37, right? They were wanting a knockout bid of, or a bid to open the books and have a proper conversation, I think, at 33, maybe 32, 33, which BHP were not going to do, because they were saying there's not that many that much risk for you to take. We're going to deliver on this. And they were saying, well, we think there is some risk regarding this, and it could take a little while, and so on and so forth. And then they've countered that by saying, actually, we'll take all the risk, we'll do it ourselves. But my argument for Anglo American was, look, guys, your share price was at 16, 17, £18 just 6 months ago, and you were doing nothing to extract or deliver value for your shareholders. Someone else is trying to give you a premium now and leave you with a little bit less of the work to do. And you're going, no, we don't want that $49 billion deal. Thank you very much. We'll do it ourselves over the course of the next 2 years. Over the next 2 years, as you say, there'll be somebody else coming in. I think it will likely be Glencore or somebody else, maybe in Freeport-McMoRan. I don't want it to be Rio because I own Rio already, and I don't want their shares to go down because they're trying to do quite a sizable deal for the for their size. But right now they're left with a strategic nightmare because they've got to expedite now. De Beers, yeah, coal, iron, you name it. They're going to have
don't
to get.
Forget Woodsmith. They've got that hideous potash mine in North Yorkshire.
That we're talking about, which needs about another $10 billion to be spent on it to get anything done. So
exactly.
They've got loads of work to do. And the share price finished down, I think, around 3% today at 24 odd quid. And the likelihood is that its share price could go in further down tomorrow. So I will be very concerned if they don't come out with something significant in the next month or so regarding their first strategic move. So that would be very, very, very interesting indeed. But I wanted to add something here regarding what Phil was saying and something which people aren't looking at. And this is about the American market. And there's another market which people completely ignored here, which I want to talk about very briefly. Before, I'm conscious we haven't spoken to Andy properly yet. But there's lots of deals going on in America. And Phil's probably spotted some of these. And it's probably a pending article he's going to be talking about. But in the energy space, our largest two, BP and Shell, I pray no one comes and tries to take them over or tries to merge with them or anything like that. But quietly going on in the background, right, we've seen ConocoPhillips, ticker symbol COP, and Marathon Oil Corporation announced today that they've entered into a definitive agreement to effectively merge. It's an all-stock transaction with an enterprise value of $22.5 billion. So that shows you what's going on in the energy space. People are going of that sort of size. And that would be big news here. If it was a £22 billion company being taken over, it'd be a FTSE 100 significant company being taken over. So that's happening. Where are we now? Yesterday, you had Hess basically saying that to their shareholders, the proposed merger with Chevron. Historically, Chevron's been like one of the behemoths of the energy space in America. So a proposed $53 billion merger there. No one's talking about it in the UK because it's over there. So there's just stuff going on which we need to keep an eye on. And I suspect there's going to be more in that space. And if they're merging over there, they might come all over here looking as well. I've got one and a tiny little non-producer company in the energy space, which I've got in my locker that I'm just keeping an eye on, and I hope they don't come for it. But you've got to be careful because I think we're going to see more takeovers in spaces and of sizes which we haven't expected. So we'll have to wait and see. So just keep an eye on Exxon and others to see what they do next. Phil, have you looked at the energy space, by the way?
Yeah. Anglo's is definitely, almost a definite to get taken out in the next 12, 18 months.
Yeah, I think we all agreed on that. Yeah.
I think the thing that a lot of us have been missing is that, there's been so much talk about, net zero and this kind of thing that, it misses the point that the world needs these raw materials that these mining companies and exploration companies produce. The world is not going to suddenly stop using oil or gas. It certainly needs a lot of copper, iron ore, steel, that kind of thing. And I think that these companies have arguably been significantly undervalued by the stock market. Yes, they're cyclical. They're very sensitive to changes in the economy. But they're scarce. They have scarcity value, particularly things like copper. So I think there's more going on here. I think certainly in Europe, the valuation discount, and certainly in oil, between you look at the big European oil companies, Shell, BP, Total, Eni in Italy. trading at big discounts to the American, the American oil producers. They've narrowed slightly, but you know the American companies are not on big multiples. Huge, great cash flows, big dividends, buying back their own stock. There's a lot to like about them, and I think my sort of general view is that I think value investing is on the verge of a big comeback. And if it is, and if I'm right in that, then I think that these kind of companies are going to play a big role in that.
Agreed, agreed, mate, agreed. Right, I'm going to quickly just clarify something here. We spoke about the markets in the last pod, Phil, and you were talking about and hoping, you know, that it would get the some momentum to push on to do the 9,000 this year. And then everyone's friend came out last week and dropped a, well, just dropped a oner on the markets and came out and said, I'm calling a general election. Yeah. So the markets actually peaked, our current peaked, 8,474 on the 15th, which was the Wednesday we'd recorded the podcast, right? 2 weeks ago. And today the FTSE 100 closed down 0.86%, 71 points. That's 8,183. So we've actually lost in the past 2 weeks, essentially just shy of 300 points from the intraday high. FTSE 250 closed down 1.3% today, just still above the 20,000. But I suspect that could go if we get some more negativity, and I suspect we could lose the 8,000 on the FTSE 100 unless we get some good moves and some good RNS is coming out in the next week or so, and then people start to get jittery, I suspect. FTSE AIM All shares sitting right on the cusp today after falling 1%, sitting at 800.27, so right bang on that sort of support level. But that I suspect could be going if we don't get some good news. Going back to what you were saying, Phil, about the other large entities that you spotted, these 15 companies or so, regarding takeovers. I think if people were to spend the time utilizing the likes of SharePad, they would find it a lot easier to identify some of those 15 stocks. And I suspect a lot of them will be actually higher quality stocks in the FTSE 350. And that's probably a better place to look rather than AIM, because the problem with picking AIM stocks that you think are going to be getting a catalyst for takeover is that takeover might not ever come. And what will then actually come is the company coming back to the market asking for cash. And as Henry and I have found out, I'm sure Andy's found out in the past, when they come back with a begging bowl, it's usually a 5 to 10 to 15% discount. And the shares that you hold then get discounted down to that value, if not just above, a bit below. And you get diluted in the process. So it's sometimes better to go for FTSE shares on a sum of parts basis or on a intrinsic value basis, which don't need cash. So that would be my advice to anybody that's doing a bit of research. Right, I think it's time. We've kept our guest Andy flying around in circles here, and not allowing him to land on the pod properly. So I'm going to introduce you, ladies and gents. For those of you that are not on YouTube, you need to go over there now. We've got a handsome bearded man with a coiffed hair. He's got a better hairstyle than Henry, actually. That's rare we have a guest with a better hairstyle than Henry. And I'm not being biased because everyone loves Henry's hairstyle. But we've got Handy. He's got his name on the thing here as Andy B. We'll let him share his surname if he wants to. But Andy's a pilot, ladies and gents. So he's used to turbulence. He's used to a bit of volatility on the runway. Everyone trying to juxtaposition for takeoff. But Andy's going to introduce himself to you, ladies and gents, tell you about his investing strategy, some of the stocks that he holds. And obviously, he's on the pod because we think he's a highly respected individual. So he's going to be here to share some insights about his journey with you all. And when we get a chance, Phil, Henry, and I will ask him a couple of questions. Hopefully, nothing too taxing. There's another one for you there, Andy. Henry's shaking his head at my jokes. He's not very good tonight. But Andy, over to you, sir. Introduce,
Yeah.
share, welcome from all of us.
Hello. It's an honor to be on the podcast. My name's Andy. I consider myself an amateur investor. I find the whole Private investor term maybe implies you have lots of money in your bank account, and I most certainly do not. I don't have a background in finance particularly. I did study business at university, decided having done 4 years, it wasn't really for me. So I retrained as a quantity slayer, and I went off and worked in construction project management and construction finance for 10 years. So similar path to Henry, did the same degree at the same university, weirdly, and then both ended up in construction.
Wow.
So yeah, and I ended up spending 10 years in construction, really enjoyed it. And I ended up in the renewable energy end of that field, having done some very fancy construction projects in the more traditional sense. Ended up building solar farms for a living for a few years. At that point, I was early 30s, I'm going to say, and an opportunity for a career change came along to retrain as an airline pilot.
As you do, as you do.
As you
Sorry.
do,
Construction's
Well,
airline pilot. Oh my
yeah,
days.
it's not a well-trodden path, but it's something I'd always wanted to do. I'd gone off to university over September the 11th, so when I graduated, the opportunity just wasn't there for me, and like all things in life, went off and found something else to do, and kind of forgot about what I'd always set out to start doing. So anyway, I've retrained as an airline pilot. I did that about 10 years ago now, and that's what I've been doing ever since, really. In terms of my investing background, I started very, very, very small indeed when I finished university. My first share was a company called Next 15 Communications, now called Next 15 Group. Put £500 in, and that was by far and long way my best ever investment. That 30 bagged that particular share. Never been able to recreate that success in any other share since. But that one share has carried me quite a long way. Because of my
Okay.
job, I'm up very early in the morning going to work. I'm flying, or I'm at home asleep. So when the RNS has come out, I'm asleep or I'm in airplane mode. So for me, the important thing with my investing is that I'm not dependent on reading the RNSs to make decisions in the morning, that I'm taking long-term investments. For me personally, if I'm buying a share with you for less than 5 years, that's a short-term investment for me. Ideally, the companies that I'm buying, I would like to be holding for 10 years, 20 years, something of that order. I do break that rule sometimes if there's odd little special situations here and there, but generally, that's what I like doing. I like the fact I can go on holiday, not check my shares for a week, and come back and not worry about them. So as I've evolved,
Brilliant.
I've been investing in more and more larger quality companies. I consider myself a value investor of a small V. I don't focus on that entirely. I will touch almost anything, but I do not like overpaying for my shares. So I don't really care which market it's in. I don't really care what business it is. So I don't care if it's profitable or not, but I don't like overpaying for it. So that's kind of where I come from, and where I'm at the minute with my investments. At the minute, I've recently been investing in quite a few REITs. I've always held REITs over the years, real estate investment trusts. But just last year or so, some of the opportunities that seem to be out there in that market seem very, very good indeed. Also, the investment trust space more generally, I find them quite easy to analyze. Look at the discounts they have available. They're quite open with the assets that they hold within it. So you can go through the portfolios of real estate and assess for yourself whether you think they have any value, whether you think that they're going to be relet if they become vacant, things like that. So I like to keep my investing very, very simple. I like companies I understand. I like companies I can keep an eye on, because I don't want to be committed spending lots of time on it.
Brilliant. Love that. Very concise, sir. Very direct. I love what you said about the long-term investing. It appealed to the three of us here. And that short term is 5 years. As we know with the stats, most investors now are holding something for sub 6 months. That's what
Yeah.
that, and they're classed as investors, which I find staggering. But yeah, but short term, 5 years, up to 10. And like you say,
I
special
think though, on
situations
that
like
point though, Pete, with the short-term investing, each to their own, and if it works for people, that's perfect. But it does also
absolutely.
present quite a good opportunity for people like those of us on the call here, and I'm guessing quite a lot of the people listen to this podcast. So similar to Phil, who mentioned before that he'd gone through and found 15 or so shares that piqued his interest. I was just having a look through at shares trading at or about kind of 52-week lows or significantly below COVID lows. And I was really surprised, to be honest, at some of the names that came up. So for instance, Croda, that I know you've talked about on the podcast before, that's 55% off its all-time highs at the minute, and yet its earnings per share are nearly 11% lower. So I look at a company like that and I think, well, maybe people have been in and out and they've been trading that quickly. But at the minute, that's on a huge discount based on comparison, admittedly, to historical share prices, which may be not the best judge, but that's 55% off. So just a few others that I came up very, very briefly. Diageo, that's very, very similar. That's over a third off, closing on 40% off all-time highs. Earnings per share are higher than pre-COVID. And if you look at comparisons with like US distillers, it's hugely cheaper. Watches of Switzerland group that everyone was talking about during COVID, that got up to £15 during COVID. And this month it's been down at £3.25. It's still got higher earnings per share than before COVID. But in that time, the share price has gone up fivefold and then come straight back down again. Similarly, Water Intelligence I had a look at.
I've taken a position in Watches of Zurich now.
Watches of Switzerland, have you?
You mentioned it before. I wasn't going to say anything. Okay. You've mentioned it, so I'm going to hold my hand up and say, I have taken a position there with regards
to
what they're
going to do
and how they're
going
to do it going forward. But I can wait 2 or 3 years for that to happen. So we'll see what happens with that. But yeah, you're spot on. There's loads and loads of companies, mate, at good value. But as I've said here, and I'll say it again, most investors are not interested in stocks near 52-week lows. They're more interested when everyone else is talking about it and it's nearer to 52-week highs or 2-year or 3-year highs. But the article that Phil's written will cover some of those stocks that are lowly valued, are off the radar at the moment and not being talked about by everybody, not attending various seminars and not attending various shows with lots of a large audience to actually sell the stock to. So yeah, and there's some good quality stocks out there. I had Charlie Huggins talking about Croda, which my dad's got a shed load of, and he's going, why don't you tell me to sell? You know, I was like, mate, if I told you to sell it 2 years ago, you'd go, I'm not listening to you, which is what he's always done. And he's always been right. So yeah, and I've got my eyes on that for him. And so I'm tracking Croda, but there's loads of good quality companies out there at the minute. What do you think, Henry, regarding what Andy was saying about long-term holding and some of the stocks? Because some very interesting names there. And he's also in the space that we're in regarding REITs and investment trusts, where we've had some good luck and some bad luck. And we talk about discounts. And me and you have been in a position where I'm sure Andy's been a couple of times where the discounts just get wider. And like Phil said, they're doing buybacks now to try and stop the discount even going wider and wider. And if they pay you a dividend while you wait, it's fine. But even some of them are cutting their dividends and choosing buybacks instead.
Yeah, I mean, I think Andy's spot on. I mean, we were chatting a couple of months back about his approach, and it amazes me the amount of people that spend all this time researching, you know, looking for shares, trying to find investments to buy. And then 6 months later, they're throwing them overboard. Every couple of months, they're selling this, they're selling that, they're selling this, they're selling that. There are lots of shares on the market, but if you concentrate on the best opportunities, there aren't that many of them and they don't change that often, not to my mind anyway. And so this approach of take your time, do your research, understand your investment, buy something that's quality and then let it do its thing, to me is perfect. It's straight up my alley. And it's really refreshing to hear it from another investor, because so many investors are heckling me when I'm talking to them and go, oh, yeah, you ought to be selling that and flipping this and slicing that and chopping that, you know, and they're running around all over the place, constantly changing their portfolios. So I think, Andy, you know, over the long term, you're going to do really, really well with this approach. And I love the fact that you're looking at REITs, because right now, anybody that's holding REITs, I hold REITs, I've got a big weighting towards REITs, and they've got absolutely mullered over the last year and a half. It's been painful, to be honest, holding them. But now's the time, if you're interested in them, to be having a look. Interest rates have gone up. Now, providing Phil's not entirely on the money and interest rates aren't about to go up another 5%, there are lots and lots of good quality REITs available on quite wide discounts to their net asset value. You know, and it's not just REITs. There's also, like you say, investment trusts, particularly in the infrastructure space, that are on significant discounts to net asset value. You know, Bluefield Solar Income, UK Wind, Next Energy Solar, which I hold, they've all come off the boil. They're all at, you know, 30, 35, 40% discounts. Part of that is in reaction to the bond market. So if you can get 5% in gilts or treasuries, in theory at zero risk, why would you give it to a company to go and build a solar farm and risk them going bankrupt? Investors just aren't
Absolutely.
interested. And that's what's taken the heat out of them. Doesn't mean they're not good opportunities, though. So I think, you're looking at this the right way and hunting for value where the market's not looking.
Yeah, I agree with you, Henry. I need to say this thing though. I've had it in my mind for some time, and this thing about the churning and the activity, and we mentioned it before regarding the supercomputer that most people got in the pocket called the phone, and people are chasing the newer, brighter thing that's in front of them. But there's a I forget whose quote it is or what this who whether it's the saying originates, and it's a quote of somebody saying, "I've put put two children through." Private school from investing, and they were the two children of my broker because they've done so much trading. They put the kids of the broker, not their own kids, because they're constantly churning and buying, churning, buying and sell, buy and sell. And people don't look at that sort of waste regarding the number of shares that they have to keep buying and selling, and how much it costs to do that. So yeah, very, very important. Phil, you mentioned earlier that the bond market. How much impact? You said that, actually that's what leads everything else. And I had a conversation with somebody who was commenting about your brilliant insights regarding the markets and all the rest of it. And he was basically saying also about the watching out for the bond markets. And then we just touched on it there. Given what you're seeing regarding that, how much weighting should we put regarding REITs and investment trusts regarding the impacts that bonds and interest rates have had on them? Are the bargains to be taken right now, or should we all be a little bit like watch, wait and see, in your
Well,
view?
the honest answer is I don't know because I haven't looked at that many REITs at all for a while. The general rule of thumb is that generally, if interest rates go up, the value of most securities and assets goes down. I'm not going to bore people as to why that is, but it just makes things like cash more attractive. You therefore have to have better returns from other assets to make them more attractive. I think just getting back to the point what Andy was making and him looking for things like 52-week lows and focusing on quality on good companies. And I think you sort of it brings out one of the great advantages that the private investor has, and is that they can just sit there and wait. They don't have to trade. They can sit and wait for an opportunity to come along. And professional investors can't do that. They got to be, well, most professional investors can't do that because they have to be fully invested. And sometimes you have to wait a long time and then something will happen. But going back to what we were talking about right at the start, on the Hargreaves Lansdown thing, it's psychology plays such a big impact in this game of investing, and that people gravitate to where they feel comfortable. But actually sometimes you actually well quite often you make money in the long run by going somewhere that's uncomfortable for the masses. And it's about, there's a fine line between picking something that is depressed, that's going to stay depressed because it's a bad business, and one that so has the potential to recover. And you mentioned like businesses like Croda. I mean, Croda's going through a bit of a rough time at the moment because, this is the other thing that you've got to watch out for. And I'm seeing this more and more now, is where you're getting businesses that have had a really strong trading conditions for a few years, and then the revenues fall off a cliff because the people they were selling to bought too much of the stuff that they were selling. And you get this word called destocking. I'm seeing this a lot now, destocking, where companies come out and say, we're not going to make as much money because our customers are destocking. So that means that almost means that the previous year's profits were too good to be true, and now it's payback time. But I think this 52-week low and sort of going where the pessimism is, it's where you can have a real edge as a private investor, providing you don't sacrifice the quality of the business. You've got to invest in decent businesses. Not don't have to be outstanding businesses, but they have to be decent businesses where eventually the earnings can start growing again, and you're paying a reasonable valuation. I think the interesting thing about a business like Croda is that it's still on 26, 27 times forward earnings. And you can see these businesses that trade on very high multiples. I mean, some of these companies are getting up to mid-30s, 40 times earnings, things like Spirax Sarco, Halma, Treatt, the sort of flavorings business that was a really hot stock. And these businesses can easily halve and still look expensive. And I think that's the thing. You can see them being a long way off their highs, but they're still expensive. So that's one of the, I think valuation discipline, which is something that, in a raging bull market where people are chasing momentum, valuation is just cast out the window. I think now we're moving into an investing environment where valuation becomes a lot more important again, which I think is no bad thing.
Yeah, agreed, Phil. I wanted to go back to Andy, and you spoke about holding stocks for quite some time, Andy. And I wanted to speak about your next 15 journey, how long you held that for, the psychology of holding it, because obviously it wasn't a smooth, I'm throwing all these puns in now, smooth takeoff to being a 30 bagger. But how long did you hold it for? What did you have to do to actually keep a hold of it, given the difficulty of all these sort of small cap stocks? And when did you decide to reduce, or what have you done with it, given the fact that you're
So
a
I
30
actually
bagger
still
now?
hold it. So I've held that one since 2005, I believe. So coming up 20 years,
Brilliant.
I've held that one now.
Brilliant. Well done.
To be honest, when I bought the share, it was off an Investor's Chronicle tip when I was young and naive and didn't know any better than to just blindly follow tips. And the share price literally didn't move for 2 weeks. It was absolutely static. And I got so bored watching it. I did come close to selling it at that point, thinking, well, this is, I've been sucking into this. And I just kind of forgot I ever really held it. And at that point in investing, you could quite easily get 5-6% in an ISA. You could quite easily get 8-10% in a regular savings account. And for me at that point, that was a much more appealing option, seeing every single month some cash coming into my account, than it was holding shares that didn't really seem to do much. So I kind of forgot about it for genuinely probably 3 or 4 years before I even looked back into my brokerage account and saw what had happened with it. And that point, it was probably up, I don't know, 70, 80%. So I've never actually bought any more of it. I've just top sliced it all the way up. Just when it reached points where its valuation seemed to get ahead of itself. For those that don't know, it's kind of a management consultancy and marketing company for the tech sector. So it works with Google, Apple, Microsoft, you name it. They are clients of Next 15. So I was very fortunate, really, that I didn't have to worry so much about position sizing just because it did so well. It was working in my favor. I could just top slice all the time. Whenever I needed a bit of extra cash, I could just take it straight out of Next 15 because it did so well. And I think the fact that that happened purely by luck with my first share, and the fact I have now held it for approaching 2 decades, has probably had more of an impact on my investing technique today than almost anything else. I think that's true of everything in life. The first investing book you ever read is probably going to have more of a bearing on your technique than anything else. And how the first ever investment you make goes is probably going to have a similar effect, really. I've done nothing with it aside top slicing. I think I've had odd dividends along the line that I've reinvested into it, but that's about it, really. That's all I've done with that one.
Whether you are an experienced or new investor, you know how valuable it is to conduct portfolio enhancing analysis and to have easy access to data that will give you the edge. As a Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener, you can access an exceptional offer via SharePad from ShareScope. the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. This special Twin Peaks offer is available to new subscribers only, and you can subscribe using the promo code TWINPEATS. The incredible and exclusive offer means that monthly subscribers will get their second month free, and annual subscribers will get their 13th month free. Sign up and subscribe to SharePad today using the TWINPEATS promo code, and you can save up to £69. Visit sharescope.co.uk/sharepad for further details and subscribe to the investing and trading analysis and data you need.
Brilliant. No, I love the fact you've kept it for nearly 20 years, like as you say, and you've chosen your strategy of trimming it when you thought it got a bit overpriced or it was a milestone sort of move regarding the returns that you were making on it. And you've reinvested some, you've rewarded yourself with some others and spent it accordingly. I like that. Henry, you mentioned that you've got some REITs as well as Andy. Is there any that you want to talk about that have had any action since we last spoke?
Not particularly. I mean, I don't like talking my own book on the show, so I'm going to avoid any specifics here. Okay. The only thing I would say to investors is that there's a lot of, with financial commentary, right, you're sat listening to the four of us right now. You might read Investors Chronicle. You might read Shares Magazine. You might read Morningstar, whatever. There are hot topics in the media, right? And at the minute, the hot topic is AI. It's semiconductors. Before that, it was renewables and ESG investing. You could argue that there's been a commodities slant at the moment in the financial press. Everybody's talking about how to get into copper, how to get into gold. Who knows what it's going to be 6 months from now? You know, weapons businesses. I don't know. But it's got rather an insidious effect if you're not careful, because you constantly end up churning where your focus is in the market and you end up chasing all these ideas. So at the moment, maybe you've gone piling into Nvidia, or you've decided you don't want to buy Nvidia on a PE of 300. So you've gone and bought some small no-name semiconductor stocks that no one's heard of, hoping that they're the next Nvidia or Nvidia buys them. Then you get bored of these semiconductor stocks when the press moves on, so you move into copper. You start buying copper mines in Chile, right? Who knows if they're getting any copper out of the ground or selling anything, but you'll go buy them and hope they do okay. Then the press moves on from copper on to the next thing. And you end up with this weird collection of companies in your portfolio. It's not really a sustainable approach to investing. It's much more sustainable to look at where the value is in the market. Look, like Phil says, at what a quality business is. Businesses that have got potential, that have got good profit margins, that have got forecast earnings growth, that are leaders in the market. Look at areas where perhaps the macroeconomic impact is depressing their valuations, like the REITs at the moment because of high interest rates, and consider what their potential might be in 5 years, or if things shift ever so slightly. You know, the IMF has just come out this week and said that the UK and the West ought to be reducing interest rates to 3.5% over the next 18 months. Now, I don't know how they've come to that figure. I don't know what methodology they've used to settle on 3.5%. But if interest rates dropped from 5% to 3.5%, savings rates would follow, presumably bond rates would follow. And therefore, assets, real estate investment trusts that are yielding 5 or 6% at the minute, may well start to see a pickup in value, because all of a sudden the income that they're paying would be so much higher than the cash and cash equivalents that are also available to investors. So, you know, on the real estate investment trust thing, I wouldn't necessarily say go and bet your house on them right now. And I don't know where interest rates are going to go, but they are a sector that's unloved for very real macroeconomic headwinds. But those headwinds might not be there in another 6 to 12 months.
Agreed, mate. Caution. But we're going to go away from caution, because we've got somebody who flies planes here, and he's got one that he wants to talk about regarding some risks, some fraud, some payments even, I think, Andy. Do you want to just give us a quick talk about that one and why? Why would you
So
go and
having said
look there?
everything I've said about liking companies that I can invest in for 10 or 20 years, this is a company which does not necessarily fit that box. It also doesn't necessarily fit the value box, but one of the things I think via aviation that is drilled into me is discipline, patience, watching the market. And you know, we do that at work all day long, you know, being really, really judged in our decision making, and making sure we collect all the information we can and doing things in a timely fashion. So this particular company, it IPO'd in 2021, right in the middle of the COVID boom at $28. It's US listed. I was tempted to buy it at the time because it was very interesting. Thankfully, I didn't, because it's gone all the way down to about, I think, $4 at one point. Currently trading just over $6. Had quite a good run up last couple of weeks. The reason it caught my eye is that it's currently on 52-week highs, so the opposite of what we were just talking about. The company's called Riskified. It's an Israeli-founded business, but it's listed in the US, and it operates in the e-commerce fraud field. It's got $1 billion US dollar market cap, $450 million of cash deposits and investments on the balance sheet, and no debt. It's got gross margins of averaging about 45 to 50%, and sales are growing at about 20% per year, which we will come back to. They've only just broken into profit, and it's an EBITDA profit rather than a real profit, but that's the metric that they choose to use. But looking at price to sales, they're on about 3.5 this week. So the closest company I could think of, given this is an AI security company, was Darktrace. Before Darktrace's takeover, they were trading on about 5x sales. So it's a bit cheap, and Darktrace was trading. The CEO and founder hold 8% of the business. So to explain what Riskified do, they try and stop online retail fraud. So they basically have a plugin on websites that screens customers trying to buy goods on e-commerce websites. That tries to flag up to the retailer whether it's likely to be a fraudulent transaction or not. And it will either stop the transaction going through or halt it before the goods are shipped. And the sorts of fraud that they prevent are very, very easy to understand. So some of the key examples they give are fake credit card chargebacks, whereby a customer buys an expensive good, claims to have never received it, and gets a refund via their credit cards that the retailer doesn't get paid. There's other growing forms of fraud with fake returns, whereby people buy a high value, say, piece of outerwear, ask for a refund on it, and then ship a actual fake good back. Or in some cases, they will ship a box full of bricks back, hoping that the retailer will refund them before they actually open the box and find out what's inside it. So Riskified operate in two key markets. They operate lots of markets, but two of them are the largest sectors. It's online fashion retail and travel retail. So some of their clients include Prada, Shein, already talked to them before, but De Beers, Diamonds, and Dolce & Gabbana. In the travel sector, Last Minute, Trip.com, and Booking.com are all clients of theirs. So Riskified estimate that 10 to 15% of all online transactions are declined by the retailer due to suspected fraud. And they help to reduce that figure because obviously within that 10 to 15% are customers who are genuine but who are flagged by the retailer as fraud. They also use AI to reduce the costs. So a lot of these companies like Amazon have huge fraud prevention departments. So by using AI, you can reduce the overhead cost as well as reducing actual cases of fraud. Riskified think that they can increase sales 8% in retailers, and they can reduce the cost of fraud by 39%. That's both the actual fraud itself and the cost of administering it. If they get it wrong, they insure the client against the fraud. So say a fake gets returned and Riskified do not spot that client coming, Riskified cover the cost of the client. So it's quite an interesting win-win for clients, in that they reduce their costs, they have higher sales, and they are insured if the subcontractor, i.e. Riskified, get it wrong. Riskified think that for every £1 a client spends with them, it will save the client £6. So it's quite an easy sell. And that can be witnessed in their client retention rate, which the figures I had were a couple of years old, admittedly, but they had a client retention rate of 98%. That 98% of customers are also spending more and more money. So the 98% is effectively becoming 117% because they're spending more each section. So why do I think now is the right time to buy into Riskified? I had a look, and the shares have done very well over the last few weeks. They've just broken into profit, and they are guiding for improvements going forward. There's a few key reasons I think this might continue. Firstly, they're big in fashion, and for fashion, supply chain is changing very, very quickly. Back when I was younger, you go to a shop and you buy your clothes, the chances of that being fraudulent were next to zero. Then you've gone to people like ASOS, where there's a good chance of committing fraud with retailers such as that. And now you've got retailers in the Far East, such as Shein, shipping thousands and thousands of miles directly to customers. So the chance of fraud in those situations is exponentially increased. Riskified are branching out more into live events, so gig tickets and the like, food and electronics are big growth areas. And they do have a strong network effect that they're screening $120 billion of transactions every single year. They're building more and more data on what could be fraudulent. So as they continue to grow and screen more data, they can be more accurate and sell more stuff, basically. About a third of the company is employed in R&D. They're constantly developing new products and fine-tuning the products they've got. So there's a chance for them to upsell new products to existing clients. They're about $1 billion company. They've got $92 million of share buybacks authorized at the minute. The recent earnings call, they left their sales forecast unchanged. They are growing at the minute. But EBITDA, they increased by 10%. And if you do look at a chart for them over the last couple of years, they've been trading between $3.50 and $6.50 a share. They're currently at 620. So I just quite like the position they're in at the minute. They have gone through a really tough period. The directors do seem very motivated to get it profitable. And I think it's a good chance that if these shares break out a little bit higher, it could be quite an interesting company. They've only got a very small share of the market at the minute in terms of online retail as a whole. It's always very, very difficult to work out total addressable market, but it does seem like there is a huge potential here for this company. And I just find their proposition quite simple, quite easy to understand. It's quite compelling for their customers. Just quite an interesting company, really. So I don't hold it. I may look at starting a position this in the next couple of weeks. It's not one I typically look at, but I just like the business model a lot, and I like a lot of the stuff they're doing.
My first question to you, Andy, is given the fact that with Phil and more so Henry of late, are always looking more globally now, how did you come about finding that one? What led you to that? Before we get onto the main questions from Phil, what led
Yeah,
you
so
to
this.
that particular stock? Were you looking at something else and led you to it, or were you flying flying somewhere and you saw them in
No,
action?
no.
What was happening?
This was one that Brian Feraldi of The Motley Fool featured on his YouTube channel probably 3 years ago now.
Right, okay.
And I watched the video, and the business model was very, very interesting. So it went straight on my watch list. And I'm a big, big, big fan of watch lists and monitoring my watch list quite closely. So it's been on there
Yes.
ever since. And I'm a big fan of trying to spot shares as they cross through 200-day moving averages. That's normally a good trigger to me, particularly on shares such as this, where it's just been falling and falling and falling and falling. Once it gets above the 200-day moving average, that to me signals that something significant has happened there. And that it's probably a share I want to go back and have a little look at again. So I think it's probably about 4 or 5 months ago, this one, I had an alert that it had gone above the 200-day moving average. I decided to go back in and have another little look at it. So yeah, it's been on my watches for a while, and that's where it came from originally.
Brilliant. No, thank you for that. And for those that haven't had a look or had a listen, you need to probably consider following Brian Feraldi on Twitter, and that's just his name. I interviewed him a couple of months back. Very smart cookie. Been around. He's got a massive following on YouTube and on X and other platforms. And he's a very good educator regarding stocks as well, and a very likable guy. So you can find his interview on Investing Matters. Going to go to you first, Phil, regarding Riskified. Not going to use any puns with it, but what are your thoughts on the particular company before we go to Henry? Size, market, maybe?
I think the market is a very interesting one, and it's one that is clearly growing. I did a bit of homework on this before we came on, and it's a business that's been growing its revenues quite strongly for a while, and has only just really moved into profit. I think. You need to see, but with businesses like this, you need to see some real traction in profitability. And I think The thing that strikes me is that this is a very crowded space in terms of the number of companies that are playing in this market. There's a lot of sort of smaller kind sort of companies that are all trying to grab a slice of this market. And the interesting thing as well is if you look at the recent sort of revenue growth of this business, it is starting to slow down quite a bit. So you've had this rapid growth in revenue without any profit, and now the revenue is sort of slowing down to, sort of more, I don't know, not normal, but sort of modest levels. If you just bear with me a second, I'm just gonna look at the quick forecast for this.
I think it was roughly 20% they were saying in the earnings call that revenue's growing out at the minute, give or take. Which, yeah, I'd agree. It's not astronomical for what you'd assume would be a very easy sell. So there is a question mark hanging over why that's not a bit higher at the minute, definitely.
Yeah, I think I'm looking at the forecast now on SharePad, and they're for sort of 10, 12%, 13% revenue growth over the next 2 to 3 years. I mean, the earnings growth is expected to be very, very strong. So it is showing that, if these analysts' forecasts are right, then even though the revenue growth is slowing down a bit, they've now reached a level of revenue that can cover the overheads. And even with more modest growth, a lot of that extra revenue is dropping through into profits. And you're looking at just looking at the forecast here, you've got the earnings per share is forecast to be 17.8 cents US cents in 2024, and for that to more than double by 2026. So the shares are on 33 times forecast earnings at the moment, but if the profits come through, that they fall to a multiple of about 16. My concern with something like this is that the margins aren't particularly high, and you would think given the value add that this company is supposed to be providing its customers, that it could charge a reasonable price for that, and that actually it could make quite high margins. And if I was going to dig into this company a bit more, I would be looking into the margin side of it, because they seem quite low to me, only sort of like 3, 4, 5% next couple of years, which is for a business like this, you would think it should do a bit better than that.
Tech wise, yeah, I agree. Agreed. Any thoughts on Riskified, Henry? Thank you for that, Phil.
I really like it as a company. I really like it as a business. It's not one I've ever heard of before, but there is a huge amount of online fraud going on. So it's in a sector that, to me, like, it's an easy win. It's a bit like cybersecurity. There's a huge amount of cyber fraud going on. Therefore, if you've got a product that reduces it, easy sell. A bit like Phil, though, just because that theory works doesn't mean that it reflects in the share price. I've got a terrible track record messing around with cybersecurity businesses. I've given up on them now because you get the marketing material, you read the business plan, you see the forecast, and you think everything's rosy. And then somehow, quarter after quarter, they don't quite hit the targets and they don't quite perform the way they were going to, and it doesn't quite work out. Having said that, Riskified, to me, the just started turning a profit, and that's quite a major milestone for a tech business. I'd want to see it being profitable for a little while longer. And I'm also curious, Phil's flagged these thin margins, which to me is a big red flag also on a tech business. They should have fat margins. I'd be really interested to see what's causing that. I've not gone away and had a look at the financials, but that would probably be my next step with this. It has really interested me, so there's a good chance this is going to end up on my watch list, providing I don't see anything in those financials that really scares the living daylights out of me.
I think
Thank you for
one
that,
thing
Henry.
that's quite interesting with this company is when you look at the case studies they give of online fraud, they obviously can't be too candid about what they're preventing because fraudsters will pick up on that and immediately find a way to circumvent it. But one thing they do talk about is fraudsters who are actually using ChatGPT and the like now to commit fraud. So you have fraudsters using AI, and really they see the way going forward to counter that is that the security companies need to be heavily, heavily invested in that AI fraud prevention space. So there's a lot of buzzwords there from the company. I appreciate that. It's not my typical investment, but I just find it quite a fascinating proposition, really. And obviously growing the amount of data they have all the time. 1 billion valuation is tiny to bigger companies like Google Pay or someone like that who might want to take them out. Yeah, just one I find fascinating.
It is a really interesting business, and I think the big question mark for me, not knowing an awful lot about the space, is how do the payment processors currently handle this? So I get retailers have got fraud prevention teams, but presumably credit card companies have also got their own massive data sets of fraud modeling because they don't want to get hit with the chargebacks either.
Yeah,
And I'd
that's a
be
good question.
really interested to see how this approach stacks up with their approach. Because in theory, Riskified is fixing a problem that people like Visa and MasterCard are already well onto and throwing 10 times as much money at.
Yeah, good point there. I mean, I want to go back to that mid point in the middle that Henry and Phil have made, Andy, if you can answer it, as to the question regarding why their margins for a tech firm in that particular space is not fat. Why is it so thin?
Yeah, so
Have you got any, have you got any thoughts on that?
the report I got before said that their gross margins were about 45 to 55%. So they do have like a lot of R&D. They do employ 700 people in total in the company. So, and those are going to be quite highly paid computer programmers, AI staff, stuff like that. So I honestly think it's probably just their fixed costs are quite high. They're based in Tel Aviv, rent is not cheap out there. So hopefully, you would hope that that gearing, as they grow revenue, hopefully they can reduce the amount they need to spend on R&D, and they can really leave it at to get a bit more profit out of it. But yeah, it's something I'd have to have a little bit more look at to work out why it's not all falling through to the bottom line. But certainly, the headline margins that I look at look pretty decent to me, albeit not as good as some other tech companies, admittedly.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. Phil likes to see profitability drop into the bottom line, mate, onto the P&L sheet. I'm going to quickly talk about a share that I do not own here. I was going to talk about two of them in the related space, but I'm conscious of the time we've been on here already, Andy. And this is connected to gold because everyone's either buying or selling gold. Institutions, governments have been hoarding gold, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But given my mining exposure, I've decided to go down a slightly different route regarding this. So I've gone down the retail side of it. And this company is H&T, ticker symbol HAT, HAT is a ticker symbol. And the price as of close today was at £4 per share. The price range, 52-week price range, is 305 to 502. So at £4, it's sitting right in the middle of the Fibonacci range of 50%. Year to date, the share price is down 7.4%, forward PE of 7.1. 3 year average forecast PE is 11.8, so it's down below the 3 year average. Pre-tax is 21.4% versus the 3 year average of 19%, so slightly above that. Debt to market's increased over the last 3 years to market cap, sorry, of 37.4. Forecast yield is 4.6%. 5 year CAGR isn't all that to be shouted at 4.8%. It's got a market cap of 173, so it's a tiddler, right? So it's small, very, very small stock. And enterprise value is 227 million. So obviously it's lower price than its enterprise value. Its turnover is mainly UK, 98.5%. All these figures are on Sharepad, by the way. But I'm interested in this because of its pawnbroking side. And as we get people sitting here with the interest rates being where they are and maybe getting into some financial difficulties and all the rest of it, more and more people will sell some of their jewelry or pawn some of their jewelry or loan it to them to make some money on the actual jewelry. So there's pawnbroking side, retailing side, Pawnbroking makes up 41%, retail makes up 22%, gold purchasing makes up 9.4%, sorry, 19.4%, sorry. And then they get scrap as well, pawnbroking scrap at 12.6%. And they even do some currency foreign exchange stuff as well. So I'm just thinking regarding the pawnbroking side, gold purchasing side, and the retail sale of new and secondhand jewelry and watches and gold scrap, that they might be but get a bit of a catalyst as the markets become more and more difficult for people that find themselves in financial difficulties, or they've found themselves with gold going up because gold's been going up incrementally year to date. They've got some gold, they do not need it, it's got no sentimental value, and they decide, you know what, I'm going to cash in while the price of gold is really good, and that might help the profitability of H&T going forward. Then an AGM on the 16th of May, which is just less than 2 weeks ago. And basically they said that the margins are improving as expected. Gold purchase and scrap revenues are benefiting from strong gold price. They've added three additional stores into their estate this calendar year, made one small closure. So currently they've got 280 stores, which is quite a good footprint across the UK mainly. And the chief exec, Chris Gillespie, basically was saying the AGM, it is pleasing to be able to report a solid start to the year with robust demand across the group's product offering. I look forward to updating the market further as the year unfolds. And as always, I would like to pass on my grateful thanks to colleagues, blah, blah, blah. So I think that's one to investigate. I don't own it. I think it's on solid sort of ground regarding the growth. Not going to blow the lights out. Sort of stock you could sit and hold and compound for like Andy says 5 to 20 years if you wish. And I'm not sure if there's many other industries apart from a certain industry that's been out and around longer than pawnbroking. Go to Andy first on this occasion, I think. Andy, any thoughts on pawnbroking?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I've just pulled it up here on my computer. It looks like it's got a trailing PE on the website I'm using of about 5, a yield of about 4. It all looks really good, to be honest. For me personally, it's a little bit below the 200-day moving average. It's probably one I'd wait before I went into. It is showing earnings per share looking to shrink a little bit this year, so I'd have to do a bit more investigation into that. It does look like it's carrying a bit of debt, but at the same time, it's a very simple business. Having never used a pawnbroker before or even having set foot in one, I have no idea of the actual mechanisms, how they operate or how the gold price would affect it. But it does say I've just bought the iShares physical gold ETF in the last couple of weeks, seeing it hitting new 52-week highs. Lots of people are talking about it. I think another tangential thing that might affect the gold is that, you know, the Indian stock market's done very well. Indian people like gold a lot. If you've been to an Indian wedding, you will have seen vast amounts of gold. And that kind of dynamic of the Indian stock market over the last few years being very, very strong is almost sure in parts of the UK to trickle through to the demographics that might use these services. So yeah, I think it's got a lot of tailwinds. It's very interesting. It definitely looks very, very cheap indeed. I don't know if it's one I'd buy just because I don't really understand how they make their profits, but it's certainly an interesting company.
Thank you very much. Going to go to you next, Henry, before Phil gives me a kick.
Yeah, interesting angle mentioning about the gold. I think from memory, their gold purchasing and sort of gold sales as percentage of revenue is about a fifth of their revenue. Yeah. I looked at this myself a couple of years back, and as I recall, it was about a fifth was tied to gold. To me, there's bigger political risks here. You know, we've been in a market where businesses were allowed to do pretty much whatever businesses wanted to do. We've got a change of government coming in, and I can see there being pressure on pawnbroking businesses who traditionally serve low-income households. The FCA has just launched an investigation into people that took out car financing, that offered car financing.
Car financing.
On the grounds that disadvantaged people were taken advantage of. It's caused all sorts of furore in the industry with everybody, most people I know saying, what a load of nonsense. If you took out a financing deal, it was on your own back. You knew what you were signing up to. You can't come back 20 years later and claim you didn't know. but I could see the FCA doing exactly the same thing with pawnbroking, just out of,
Really?
you know, almost out of nowhere.
I had not
So for
thought
me,
about
that's
that
one
angle,
that.
Henry. No, thank you for pointing that out. I had not thought of that one, that angle at all, them coming after the pawnbroking industry after the car financing side. Not a thought I had at all. Thanks. Interesting. Phil's scratching his head. Phil, are you going to add to that? I can't listen to it because the door's going again. But explain to everybody your thoughts on HNT. I'll be back in a second.
I'm not sure about the rest of to the pawnbroking industry, but I totally understand the enthusiasm for gold, why investors want to gain exposure to gold. If you look at what's just happening to, money creation and debt across the world, you're seeing governments such as China buying an increase in their gold reserves away from other foreign currencies, particularly the US dollar. The simple way to do it is how Andy has mentioned. He's bought, the gold ETF. That is a very simple, cheap, easy way to play the gold market. If you're looking for sort of more adventurous ways, you want to try and let. I mean, you can buy leverage ETFs now. You could, if you, and obviously the risk with that is a lot higher. But you can buy ETFs which multiply the change in the gold price. But you need to have, a strong stomach to bear some of the potential short-term losses of those kind of products. The other way you could do it is to look at the gold mining stocks. Particularly over in the US, you could buy big gold mining stocks like Newmont or Barrick Gold, or again exchange traded funds. You can buy something that tracks the gold mining index. There's something called the GDX. There is an ETF. I think it's a VanEck is the ETF provider that follows does a gold mining company ETF GDX, and also there's one that follows the GDXJ as well, junior gold miners, which is putting even more risk in and leverage into your gold exposure. So I think, for me, that either a plain gold ETF or a gold mining ETF is probably a better way to, tap into the gold market than buying H&T. Sorry, Pete.
Absolutely fine. This is what we're here for, to debate them, mate. And ETFs have done really reasonably well. There's now talk about everyone piling to silver as well. I think we might need to have a discussion on here one day about ETFs in a fuller sort of episode. But opportunities are there, lower costs, But I mean, we're speaking about churning, and I see people churning REITs, right? And investment trusts that buying and selling within days, sometimes weeks. And I see people do this a similar sort of thing in a very short time frame regarding jumping onto the escalator in gold. It goes up 5 or 15% or whatever over a 6 month to a year period, and then they jump off and then they put it into. And I'm like, I thought the whole idea of ETS was that you just passive, you just buy it and just leave it alone. But everyone's trading everything these days. I'm not. Have you seen any of that, Andy? There's people trading ETFs and REITs very, very quickly.
Yeah, a little bit. And to be honest, I do a small amount of it. I track the 200-day moving averages on these, and I won't sell a whole position if something drops below the 200-day. But on my larger holdings, like my All World Tracker, if it's getting close to it, I might trim 20%. If it crosses through it, I might trim a little bit more just to try and capture a little bit more upside and limit the downside on it. But this isn't selling one thing wholesale and buying a different thing wholesale and then jumping to another thing. It's kind of a little bit of risk management on the downside, trying to maybe get out a little bit before stuff crashes, and try to open positions as it's improving. I wouldn't personally call it trading. It's kind of using technical indications just to maybe time a little bit better than I can do, using my own skill set. But yeah, I do see it on Twitter a little bit, people trading ETFs day in, day out. Such is life, unfortunately.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. Phil, what are you going to add? I saw you on the cusp there. What, you say something? Were you going to add something?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think if people want to trade, that's fine. I mean, there's some
Absolutely.
people are very, very good at trading, and use that to compound their, they have the mindset, they have the risk tolerance to do that, and I think that's fine if you have that. I think the points that you're making about if you're investing and you're always chopping and changing are, a good point. I think the great thing about ETFs, if you want to trade them, is obviously when you're buying them, you're not paying any stamp duty on them. And hopefully as well that they're reasonably liquid. Certainly a lot of them, they're very easy to get in and out of. So I can totally understand why, if you were a trader, you would use ETFs to trade. Cheap, easy. What's not to like?
Cool. Henry, any thoughts before we close, mate? Any thoughts regarding the last thing about ETFs, gold, or any other things that Andy has kindly shared with us?
Well, actually, yes, Peter. I've got a question for you. I have got a question for
Me,
you, as we've
for me in
got
particular, or for
for
all three
you,
of
no, for
us?
you in particular, as you've
Oh.
been giving bad one-liners all evening.
Oh dear, here we go.
Can you tell me what happens to a bad aeroplane joke?
It crashes.
It never lands.
Thank you for that. Payback. All right. Okay. I'll stop with that. Okie dokie. Andy, do you want any parting words for our listeners? Please, please, please go and follow Andy on Twitter / X at Flying Finance on Twitter. We'd love to hear from you and give us your feedback on Andy's appearance, Phil's insights, Henry's insights, and me legging it out of the room as usual to go and answer the door. And thank you all for your feedback regarding the last podcast as well, and for your comments on YouTube and your subscriptions on YouTube. We really, really appreciate it. So we thank you all for your support. Andy, I'm going to give you the parting words, mate. What do you want to say about the pod, your experience on here? Did you enjoy it? Is there anything you wanted to share before you go? Over to you, mate.
No, I enjoyed it greatly. I've been on one other podcast, and I will say it's one of those things that I think everyone should try at some point, because it does really make you go through your portfolio a little bit and really assess what you're doing there, and maybe have a bit more scrutiny in your own investing than you might otherwise. One point I just want to leave on, and it's kind of an open question. I read a column by Edmund Shing yesterday talking about the Magnificent Seven shares. So, does anyone here know how many of the Magnificent Seven outperformed the S&P in the last quarter? I was fascinated to learn this.
Outperform the
Four
S&P. I
of them.
think
Four of them.
I'm gonna say one.
I'm gonna go with all of them.
Two. So
Oh,
Nvidia and Google. All the others
Nvidia and Google.
underperformed the S&P, and I think from memory, S&P in the last quarter made 4.2, 4.3%, some of that order. So not a particularly demanding benchmark to outperform. But I thought that was fascinating, and it really reinforced to me the fact that you sometimes see these stories about Magnificent Seven and all manner of subjects, and you assume that they must all be performing astronomically well because they're mentioned all the time. But sometimes when you drill into the data, you see these anomalies, and you realize that five of the Magnificent Seven didn't perform as well as their benchmark index. Yeah, I thought that's fascinating. So going forward, that's one of those things I'm going to be looking at a bit more closely, is actually we lump all the Magnificent Seven in together and we talk about them, maybe with the exception of Nvidia as one common entity, but actually there's a huge discrepancy between how those shares are trading. And it just reinforced to me the fact I need to maybe keep a slightly closer eye on those things, and there's some in there that are clearly underperforming by quite a lot as well.
Agreed. And I think if I remember rightly, and probably Phil and I are of a similar age, the original film, Phil, how many survived at the end of the Magnificent Seven, the film?
I can't
I think it was
remember.
three, Phil. I'm a bit older than you as well, so I'm going to say three. All those listening who are of a certain age, go back and watch the film. I think three survived. I'm not saying the of those seven that we've got currently in the tech space, only three is going to survive. I'm going to say outperform is the word I'm going to use anyway. Anyway, that's just me.
Yeah.
I've been battered by Henry butchering my jokes, so I'm going to call it a day now. Right, Andy, thank you ever so much for joining us, sir. We'll look forward to catching up with you face to face the next couple of months, I think I'm going to try and organize something with Henry and Phil and a few other people. Hopefully you're on some leave and got some time where you're not sleeping. You can join us again for a proper face-to-face catch-up and a few beers. We'll call it another Guinness day, I think. Potentially do that. So, ladies and gents, that is the end of podcast 128. Thank you very much to our guest, Andy B at Flying Finance on Twitter. Thank you very much to my great co-host, Henry Viola Hare at HD Viola. Please follow him. And please follow Mr. Phil Oakley on his Substack, which you can find at Investing Stuff on Substack. So follow him there, subscribe to his musings, his writings at Shareascope as well. And I will see you, ladies and gents, in 2 weeks' time with Henry and Phil again. And we'll wish Andy safe travels at Flying Finance. So, everybody listening, wherever you are in the world, take care and God bless you all.
This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with ShareePad from ShareScoop, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.